This week on the Orville Universe podcast, we are talking about Orville Season 1, Episode 4. This week, we're talking about what happens with religious fanaticism, small-mindedness of a culture, and how are Bordas and Clydon really doing?
Right after this. Welcome to the Orville Universe podcast. My name is Matthew Carroll.
I'm Matthew Westfox.
What's up, Matthew Westfox?
I am living a life surrounded by cardboard boxes. I am moving to my new home in Minnesota on Monday, and we are deep in packing, so this is a nice break.
Awesome. That's, well, congratulations on the move. I hope it's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. I watched this week's episode while wrapping dishes, so it was a nice distraction.
Oh, nice. I have never moved that carefully. I've never had many things I care about in my life, like stuff, like music gear and video gear. That's about it. And so, like, everything else, dishes have always just been like, stack them in a seat in the car. We're just going.
That's fair. I'm probably way too meticulous about it, but part of it's also, like, a lot of it's stuff that I got when my mother passed away, and so it's got sentimental value. And then there's just, like, you know, I have a matching set of dishes, and I want to keep them, and I'm an idiot about that kind of thing. So
nah, that's cool, man. That's cool. I'm jealous of your I'm jealous of your whatever you said about it, pickiness or whatever.
Yeah, I hear you.
I'm not that way, and it's probably a pox on my life. all right, well, let's dive into this episode. What's the episode called? If the Stars Should Appear, right?
Yeah. If the Stars Should Appear.
I dug this episode a lot.
I thought it was nice. We started getting into this. This to me felt almost like a palate cleanser after the last one. In that, you know, as someone could tell just by our episode length, you know, our episode about a girl was twice as long because it was just such a deep, meaty issue. There was so much to go into, so much to talk about. And this episode felt It felt lighter, and it felt, I mean, I know we keep bringing up the Star Trek connection, but this felt so much like a just day in the life Star Trek episode, where it was a very traditional kind of, you know, experience a culture that's in terrible danger because of their small-mindedness, and so the crew has to figure out a way to overcome the despotic power and show the information to the ignorant people so that they can learn and then they can all, and then everyone can be happy and work together through technology. And I say that it sounds almost dismissive. It's not. I loved those Star Trek episodes, even though sometimes I'd roll my eyes at them a bit. And this I thought was a well done version of exactly that kind of thing. And it felt, after all the depth we had last week, it just felt nice to have something a little lighter and fun and still intellectually engaging, but not quite as like, I'm going to wrestle with this in my soul for the next 3 days.
Yeah, there's a lot less moral ambiguity in this episode.
Yeah.
There's almost nothing that the, you know, as you said, the despotic leader, there's almost nothing that you can agree with him on. Now, I did think that, when I think about this episode, before I rewatched it, I was thinking that he was the most mustache twirly villain of this show.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
And it probably is accurate, but on a rewatch, I was kind of paying attention to that fact, and they still took a moment to humanize him, even though he's horrible. There were two key moments, I thought, for him that, like, gave me a little glimpse that at least they were trying to make him a round character, even though he is clearly, as you said, the despotic despotic leader or whatever. There's a moment when he throws that guy to the death when he says, you need to judge him, and he has a crowd murder a man for being a reformer. There's a moment where he looks regretful.
Yeah.
He like steps back and he looks and he's like, he looks shocked at the, violence of the people. And you can tell there's a little bit of him that knows it's wrong. And he is convinced. And then given his later conversation where he says this system has worked for thousands of years, I do think what Mercer says, which is, no, you're only doing that because you want to be in control. I think that's true, but I don't think it is conscious. Like, I think he has subconsciously convinced himself that this is what's best for society. And like, he is a bad faith actor in the sense that he knows that what he's doing is possibly wrong, because he knows, he says, of course it's possible there's something outside of our world.
Right.
But he can't admit that because he does believe in this system that he has built is the best way to keep the society together. And so there's this weird bit of like, at least they try to give him a motivation, and a little bit of complexity. I thought even for this character being such a mustache twirling villain, to give him that little bit of depth, I thought was really cool.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice moment, and I did kind of disagree with Mercer in that moment, because, and I don't think any of this morally justifies this guy. I don't think that's at all what we're saying, but that it does help to better explain him. One of the things that I was thinking of in that moment is, you know, we have seen in our own world a number of examples where, you know, we look at the world and we see this terrible dictator. And it's easy to think, like, okay, if we just eliminate that dictator, everything will be fine. But and we have a number of countries today that have really fallen into terrible chaos. Libya is the first example that I think of, where, you know, but also Iraq or other places like that, where, like, a terrible, horrible dictator was removed, but there wasn't really a plan for what comes next, and it did fall into a lot of chaos. And I don't think by any means that's an argument to say that those dictators should have been kept in power, but it's a reason to think that like just removing a dictator isn't the easiest thing in the world. And I think because of that, especially if you are the dictator, it's easy to start thinking like there's a great essay I wrote a while ago, and I forget the name of it, but it was basically about the idea that like one of the problems with despotic power is that it traps everyone in the system, because it is so horrible that also taking it away is going to cause so much chaos. And now there becomes this, it sort of gains its own momentum of, well, we have to keep this in place because or else everything will fall apart. And I definitely got that sense from him. And especially the one thing that can happen in those kind of dictatorships is that it becomes very fragile. You know, it's like any kind of real information will break. So now you've got to control information, and you've got to label people who give bad information heretics and have them killed and all these terrible, horrible things. And certainly you can praise someone as someone who revels in that and loves that. But I love that what the show did is, I think exactly what you said, it portrayed him as like, there's a part of him that wishes it didn't have to be like this, but he has convinced himself that if he leaves, if his power falls away, if the religious fanaticism falls away, the whole society will fall apart. And so he has to like throw these people to the crowd. And to me, my favorite line is where he says something to Kelly later about how he didn't do it, the crowd did it. And I think
there's no blood on my hands.
Yeah, and a part of that I think is completely self-serving, but a part of that I think is, I mean, it is self-serving, but it's because I think he is feeling guilt, and I think he's basically lying to himself to try to say like, no, I didn't do it. That way he can sleep better at night.
Yeah, he so that's the weird thing about this character is he has a moral code, and I think that violence is distasteful to him. And he knows that he's crossed a line, and he's given himself this weird framework where he can abdicate responsibility by giving it to the crowd.
Yeah.
That in itself, like, could have been an episode, almost. Like, you could have they did that. Star Trek has that episode, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of it. Star Trek has an episode where, the two societies are warring, but instead of destroying their culture, they decide to just have these fake computer wars where they send people into chambers to die. Do you remember that original series episode?
Yeah, I do.
That's sort of the same thing, and that's that entire episode. It's like violence, instead of like dealing with the repercussions of violence, you've decided to kind of wash your hands as a society of that violence and just do it in a way that abdicates you of actual responsibility, and taking that, like putting a step between you and the violence makes it worse. There's even the like the Game of Thrones thing where you're like, I don't know if you watch Game of Thrones.
I do. Yeah, I was actually thinking of exactly this thing. So
yeah,
go ahead.
You if you're the leader, you got to be the one to swing the axe, and that's a interesting ethic. I don't know if I completely agree with it, but it's an interesting ethic for that sort of culture, that sort of time and culture, because it's like keeping you grounded to the violence you're doing so that you're not doing too much, you know?
Yeah, and I was thinking of that, especially because in this episode, our leader, who's I'm so bad with names, I apologize, but even in that whole scene where he's torturing Kelly, he's never the one to punch her. You know, there's some nameless associate of his who's the one who keeps punching her, who's the one who then administers the terribly painful drug. You know, it's always someone else so that he can keep his hands clean.
That's a really good
point. And he can always maintain this idea of, oh, you know, I just want to help you. I don't want to have to do this. And I think that's often portrayed as someone just being especially sadistic. I think in his case, he believes that. And that doesn't make him any better. It makes him in some ways even morally worse because he's lying to himself to justify the horrible things he's doing. But as you said, it gives him depth.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. And the more, yeah, that's a really great point about the guard punching and not him, because it really does, it really is fit the theme of his character. And that's cool. It makes me like this show even more, because honestly, thinking back on stuff, like I said, I thought of him as the most mustache twirly villain of this show. And I always thought of him as kind of like a paper thin villain, but rewatching, I was like, oh no, they took some real thought into what his moral framework was like. And yeah, that's awesome. I just love this show.
One thing I will say, and this is kind of a spoiler for later things to come, and I'll try not to spoil it for those who are kind of like watching along with us and haven't seen later episodes yet, but just to kind of drop a theme, you know, one thing this episode also explores is the idea of religious fanaticism and sort of like the role that religion can play in blinding a society to the truth and making people want to just kill all heretics and things like that. One of my frustrations with early Star Trek, especially, is, you know, Roddenberry was very famously very anti-religion, very much an atheist, and especially when he was starting in the 60s, like, yeah, very much needed. I mean, even today, like, religion does so many horrible things in our world. I totally understand the desire to portray religion as always this kind of stupid, unscientific thing. It's not my opinion, but I understand where it comes from. But it did frustrate me that in almost every Star Trek episode before Deep Space Nine, where religion comes up, religion is always portrayed as this kind of like these ignorant rubes who don't know better, and if only they had technology, they would know not to believe in religion. And so I saw this episode, and I was a little like, okay, I guess that's what we have to do in these kind of universes. And I just, watching it today, again, felt better because, as we'll later see when we actually explore the Krill, who we've fought a couple times but know nothing about, the show actually explores the religion of the Krill in a way that is, I mean, their religion is clearly really problematic, but it's not just, to extend the metaphor, that the religion isn't just mustache twirly either. You know, that we will later find that there are some portrayals of religion that are more nuanced and more open-minded towards the idea that religion isn't necessarily a bad thing. And I like that. Knowing that that is coming makes it easier for me to deal with, because I think portraying religion is often horrific and terrible and controlling a society. Like, great, we need more of that. But I just like that it's not always that.
Interesting. I'm interested to see when we get to those episodes, because I don't really remember them doing that much depth with the Krill religion, although mm-hmm. I think we're heading towards even more of that with what's going on in the show now. But I don't really remember much depth being portrayed, and that's interesting. I'm interested to get to those. Man, this show has so much stuff to talk about. I keep like thinking about more episodes that I'm like, man, I can't wait till we get to that and really dig into it.
Yeah. We brought up the idea that this is again a very Star Trek kind of episode, and I don't want this show to always just be about comparing it to, but I think there are ways in which McFarland, the writer of the show, is very clearly writing a Star Trek-style show, and so it's particularly interesting when when an episode like this is so much following the episodic kind of plot of a traditional Star Trek episode, it's interesting to me when he differs from it. So one of my first thoughts is that when they show up, like, and this is one of our first times we're seeing them have kind of contact with a, I think it is a, it's the first time we're seeing them having contact with a culture that is less advanced than theirs is. And they blow through any idea of a prime directive very fast. There is no concern here for like not, you know, interfering with their culture at all.
Yeah, that's true.
What did you think of that? Were you thinking of the prime directive in terms of what they were doing and how it compared to that, or we're not really noticing that?
I did not think about it. But the truth is, I don't know if they didn't know what they were getting into. So I don't even know if the Prime Directive would have applied to what they were doing, because they literally see a ship in danger. They have reason to believe this is a primitive culture. They're on a starship as far as they're concerned.
But they did, I mean, once they encounter that first family and can so clearly see that the family has no idea what's going on, you know, they have a shotgun and they have a kind of like Ma and Pa farmer idea.
Right.
Like, I think that at that point, if this was a traditional Star Trek show, at that point, Picard or Riker would have pulled people back and been like, hey, wait a minute, you know, do we have to worry about the Prime Directive here? What's happening with this culture? And it was refreshing, I thought, to have the Orville cast just not, that wasn't a concern. You know, they were going to have first contact, they were going to deal with it, they were going to fix it and move on.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's really interesting, the things that they leave out of the Orville because the time is different or because they think they're mistakes. Like, I think that they don't have the Prime Directive in the Union, and I'm sure they have some sort of directive to not interfere with primitive cultures, maybe. We'll see. I don't recall them ever really touching on it, but especially when they're in danger, that's something that, like, Star Trek Into Darkness, do you remember the beginning of that movie? They go out of their way not to break the Prime Directive, and even to the point where they're willing to watch a culture perish.
Yeah.
And that goes too far for me. I think the Prime Directive in general is kind of a good thing, to not mess with a culture in its development, but honestly, it's exactly what you were talking about with America getting involved in every other country and thinking it can boss them around, like that cultural superiorism. It's almost impossible to avoid if you're constantly in contact with such cultures that are so far behind you.
Yeah.
Another thing I really like about that is this show also seems to, there are cultures that are more advanced than the Union, and there are also older cultures than the Union, like this culture. Like, there's the Federation has just always seemed to be like, we're the premier culture, and we're going to go around telling everyone what it's like to be the premier culture and what they need to be like. And this is a lot more realistic to me. It's Star Trek if everything hasn't been solved, you know?
Yeah. No, I think it's definitely true. I think it's like, you know, as Star Trek went further, like, they did more and more to bring in the idea that it's not just humans bossing around a bunch of aliens in the Federation, that there can be, like, you know, non-human races that have very important roles to play in the Federation.
Sure.
And the Union does feel kind of like that. You know, as far I don't... Have we ever seen a, like, admiral or other, like, very highly placed Union official who wasn't human?
I don't remember in the full watch, but not yet. They tend to take the admirals and use them as excuses to put cameos in the show.
Yeah, that's true.
And so I think that has been their, like, driving force. So no, we have yet to see. I don't think there may be some meeting with a few admirals. Now, there is an episode coming, which obviously not to spoil, where we do see a council at the Union.
Oh, that's true.
And that was a lot of different races.
Yeah. Also, just speaking of cameos, how awesome was it when Liam Neeson shows up at the end?
So, so great. It was so, so great.
Yeah, I love him. I think he's a great actor. I've really appreciated the things he's done. And it, to me, that was one of my first moments when I was like, okay, maybe this show isn't just Seth MacFarlane's weird off-the-wall thing that will never last. Maybe other people in Hollywood are taking this seriously. Because, you know, Liam Neeson is a big actor. He doesn't, you know, guest star on sci-fi TV shows very often. And I don't know if, like, him and Seth MacFarlane are good friends otherwise, or, you know, Liam was just kind of bored and wanted to try it, or, like, he's a secret Star Trek fan. I have no idea. But it just, it lent an aura of gravitas to the show that, you know, given some of the bathroom humor of the show, I sometimes feel it's lacking a bit. So it made me happy. It made me feel like, okay, this is going to be more established in a way than I was fearing.
Yeah, that's exactly how I felt. When I saw him, I was like, oh, this show has some gravitas. Like, it's got something behind it. And I knew when I heard about the show that it was Seth MacFarlane writing and Jon Favreau directing. So I knew that it already had that going for it.
Yeah.
And so I kind of was expecting something out of it. But then when Liam Neeson shows up, it just took it to a whole nother level for me.
Yeah. One thing I'll say, this is just my minor quibble. It's not a huge deal, but, you know, for the first half of the episode, including when Kelly is dealing with the religious leader and all that, they don't have the markings that this alien race does. And so you can look at them and clearly tell they are not the same race of the people on this ship. And it bugged me a bit that no one recognized that, you know. And later even, they kind of acknowledge it in that Seth MacFarlane's character, you know, and when his group, they actually put fake markings on themselves.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was a little bit of a plot hole that the Seth MacFarlane's group thinks that that's important to do, but that no one ever says, oh, you don't look like us, you know. Something weird's happening here. What is going on?
Well, I do. Actually, I disagree with you. I think that, so when they show up at the farmer's house, the guys freak out because of how they're dressed. They never really exactly say why they're freaking out, but that was part of it in my mind. They see people they don't recognize at all. The people they don't note it, the people that don't know, that don't seem to notice, are the guards, which, given their reaction to new people and Hamilak's reaction to new people, it made me think that they've encountered people before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe they know that. And he says, sure, it's possible that those there's something beyond this world. But maybe it's possible that he's encountered other visitors and he's just murdered them like he was about to murder Kelly. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, that's legit. Certainly that scene at the farm, I thought they were more noticing like the robot man much more than the markings on someone's face. But you're probably right about that, too.
The guy says, what is that?
Right.
So about the Kalon. I think the robot was the bigger deal. And I mean, but that makes sense because they do look a lot like the people. Even though they don't have the markings. One of the things that I thought, this episode, I thought they found a voice for the show that maybe hasn't been in the past. There were less big joke moments where, like, the moment was purely contrived as a joke. There were a few, and I didn't mind them. I liked them, like the dick joke. I enjoyed the dick joke a lot.
Yeah, I thought that got old pretty fast, but I also understood it. I mean,
it did.
I did like Isaac's like not understanding what the term meant and then taking it as a compliment. That was a little bit of a fun running joke.
Yeah, that was the main joke that it was. I also just liked Mercer. It's silly and it's definitely sophomoric, but I did like when Mercer's like, just check your screen.
Yeah,
he just sends him a dick pic.
I have no idea what it is. I definitely think, though, I sort of figured he sent him, like, the Wikipedia article on dick as an insult, but, you know, I have no idea.
Well, as soon as he sends him whatever he sends him, and then the Kalon goes, I thought that men were proud of their anatomy. So I think he just sent them, like, what is a dick, or what, or either just pictures of dicks or something. I just thought look at your screen was really funny.
I agree with that, and I will say, I mean, one thing that I loved that Star Trek always tried to do, and I think Data was the best version of this, but they did it with Spock sometimes, is to have the character who doesn't know human assumptions and thus can sort of poke at them and be like, well, why do we have this? And it's a fun thing because it actually gets us to be like, well actually, why do we take this thing seriously? And I do think that, you know, our culture is very weird and puritanical about sex and, like, the way we do and don't discuss sexuality. And yes, Isaac's questions are clearly very uncomfortable and you know, fairly workplace inappropriate. But I thought it was, his just plain confusion about why humans are so uncomfortable discussing sex, I thought was actually kind of cool. Because I think it was an interesting way of, like, twisting that, of asking, like, why are we uncomfortable talking about this? And not saying that we shouldn't be, and in some ways, like, there were some legitimate reasons for Mercer to not want to get into those questions. But I it was one of the things that I love of sci-fi, and especially, like, Trek-type sci-fi, that this is doing well, was just to have that character who can make us question, like, yeah, why is this something we don't talk about more?
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually, I can't believe, in our first five or six episodes here, I don't think I've mentioned this, and it was one of my favorite things about this show when it first came on, because Isaac as a character, to me, he's very interesting because he's Data, but he's Data that doesn't want to be human.
Yeah.
Which I find fascinating because every time we have a character, even Spock, who doesn't necessarily want to be human, but the show is always kind of pushing humanity at him. Mm-hmm. There's always another. There's always someone who's different. There's Seven of Nine. There's Odo. There's Spock. There's Data. even to some degree, Worf. There's always like the other that's on the ship with the humans, and they're always trying to understand their humanity better and like become more human to some degree. I really found it refreshing on this show that Isaac comes on. He's like, no, I'm a robot, and I think I am superior to you.
Yeah.
They play it for jokes, but I actually think it's very a fascinating, different perspective that we've never really gotten on Star Trek from part of the crew.
You're right, because, I mean, there's such a sense to which Data is, on so many levels, so much better than everyone else on the crew.
Yeah.
But he doesn't – he comes from a fundamental place of, like, I'm not human enough. I need to fix this. Whereas Isaac – he comes from a position that comes off as very condescending, and on some level it is, but he also doesn't mean it to be. And because I think a lot of times part of being condescending is that you feel a need to put others down and to praise yourself. And in some way, like, there has to be some lack of self-confidence because you feel a need to assert the fact that you're better than others. Isaac doesn't have that in the slightest. I think Isaac couldn't care less about the fact that some people might think he's different or worse. He just knows as fact that he is better, faster, stronger than most of them. And doesn't understand why stating that would be a problem. And you're right, it makes such an interesting, because he comes off as, you know, really obnoxious, but you also remember from his perspective that he's just stating objective truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find his character really, really refreshing in that way.
Yeah, definitely.
You mentioned the different kind of captain that Mercer is being here to some degree with the Prime Directive and stuff. I guess that's more of the difference in the Union. I actually had a thought when I was watching this episode, particularly with his lack of toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
I think that Ed is a really interesting captain. And I put in my notes that Ed is the anti-Kirk,
mm-hmm.
because he's not about his own glory. I'm sorry, Kirk fans. I know that Kirk is not all about his own glory either. Kirk cares, but Kirk's a cowboy. Kirk always wants to, I mean, he always, and this is partly just the writing of the show, but Kirk always goes down to the planet himself. He always he's against regulations. And I like that Ed is not that way. I like that Ed is not about himself, and it extends to his feminism, honestly, the way that he treats the other, the female characters on the cast. Alara talks about it this episode. And the show itself, I think, shows itself to be a pretty feminist show, in the way Ed is talking about Alara, but also the way that, how tough Kelly is in this episode. And, I don't know. It's that classic badass scene that you see from so many men being tortured, and it's almost always a man. And I thought that was really cool, and it doesn't really call that out. And I thought that was really interesting. I like how this show treats the women equally, and I like how Ed, particularly as a character, he's the anti Kirk, but he's not Picard either. He's human.
All of the. I have three comments to make on that, so I'll try to make them brief. Like, first, just on that last thing, like, all the captains of Star Trek shows, and I think this applies to Kirk, Picard, Janeway, Sisko, Scott Bakula. I don't know his name on Enterprise, but, like, all of them are, like, alphas. You know, they are all clearly, like, strong leader types. And part of like the selling of the show is the attractiveness of those characters and like their being like a strong, appealing leader that people want to turn in and watch. And you know, there's lots of memes about like which is the, you know, the most attractive, or like, you know, the they often refer to like who's the best daddy figure, you know, that kind of thing, or with Janeway, you know, that the strong, they're all that strong, authoritarian, attractive type. Mercer is not that by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
I think he's still very attractive. I mean, like, there's a whole, you know, talk of, like, the rise of the beta male, you know, and that he's very attractive in his own ways for those, you know, in a very different kind of a way. But you're right, it's very much breaking the mold. I think...
As two beta males speaking right now, I think you're right. I think it is time for the rise of the beta male.
Somewhat. Well, and I will say, and here's the other thing I wanted to get into with that, is that I think there can be... He has a very different approach to toxic masculinity, and I think he's very aware of and critical of his own toxic masculinity. But I do think that he still is a victim of it sometimes, in a way that I think a lot of the beta male stuff can sometimes make me uncomfortable, because it feels a little like, because we're not alphas, we're not any of those bad things. And I'm just saying that, especially in terms of what you said about Mercer being very feminist, because I think you're right. I think the way he treats Alara, the way he treats the doctor, are so much better than we normally see.
Yeah.
I think he is not intentionally trying to be misogynistic in terms of how he deals with his ex-wife, Kelly, and clearly we see that relationship evolve. But I do think, and I think the show knows this and is intentionally being critical of it, and even he figures it out, but I do think he falls into some sexist tropes about how he relates to his ex-wife at first and the way he talks about her.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think they treat that relationship a little differently, though. I don't think they treat – I mean, not to, you know – yes, he definitely makes some of those jokes. And I think he has fallen into a time period in his life when he's like, yeah, my evil ex-wife. But I do think it's because of the personal hurt that human being put on him. I don't think it's because of his hatred of women or thinking all women are that way or whatever.
Right. Well, and that's what I mean. I just felt it was worth noting, because we were talking about how well he treats the women characters on the show. I think he mostly does, and I think he wants to. But I think it's a great example of how when people have negative feelings towards a specific individual, and have also been programmed with all this toxic nonsense that we get taught, it's easy to unconsciously fall into that a little bit. I think the show is very self-aware of that in a way that I really appreciate.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the show, when he does those things, it's not on his side.
Yeah.
It would be easy to write a show where literally you have the evil ex-wife on the bridge and you're having to deal with her nagging you all the time, but that's not this show.
Yeah. I think the show started as that and made us think it was that, and I know a lot of people who stopped watching because they thought it was going to be that, and I understand that, but I think the show has done a great job of twisting that, you know, and being like, wait, no, actually, that's not what we're doing here.
Yeah, I agree.
The last thing I wanted to say is, when you were saying about how it's awesome that this time it's Kelly being the strong one and taking the punches and keeping having the snide comments and never breaking down, have you seen Battlestar Galactica?
Yes.
She reminded me a lot of Starbuck in that. You
yeah,
know?
Totally. She also reminded me a lot of Mockingbird from Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, yeah. Well, same actress,
right?
I know.
Right? I was just teasing. Yeah. Yeah. But she did. I mean, that was the same character. When she shows up on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., she's also just a badass woman who's taken no prisoners. And she's playing the traditional male role. Even in her relationship on that show, she's also with a man who just can't keep up with her when it comes to battles and such. He's just not as strong as her and not as valiant as her. I think it's interesting that Adrienne Palicki, maybe it's just she plays that well, but or maybe she chooses those roles very deliberately. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, stepping way out of the sci-fi realm, but the first thing I knew her from was Friday Night Lights, where she played the character of Tara, who is, you know, not a fighter, but that's still that same badass, like, her biggest rival is sort of the cheerleader, very femme, like, pretty girl who wants to be taken care of, who's also a great character, but that she's a great contrast to that, because she's so much not wanting to be that kind of girl in a way that I love.
Yeah, me too. Love that show.
Now, we joked before we started recording that this was going to be a much shorter episode because we didn't have much to talk about. We're going pretty long already.
Right. I don't mind. But if you need to go, we can cut it short. I did two – the main two points I wanted to make about this episode I haven't even gotten to, which is really sad because we've, like you said, we're already going long.
Yeah. Oh, I don't want to. I was just using it as a way to transition because I'm guessing one of my main points is going to be one of your main points too, which is the that first discussion between Clyde and Bordas.
Oh, actually, no. So yeah, we should mention that.
Yeah. So I love that scene so much because at the end of the last episode, you know, we talked about on our episode, Clyde and Bordas have had this incredibly hard moment, and the show does a nice moment of saying, like, they are going to still try to be a couple because they still love each other, because they still love their child. And it would be easy, and a lot of shows would just say, like, would just drop that entirely. And I think, I remember starting this episode wondering, are they going to do that? Are they going to drop that? What's going to happen? And it that scene with Bordas and Clyde made me so happy because we start the episode immediately showing that they have a lot of tension between them still. But in a weird way, like, because it does a fun reveal because at first there's this whole thing where Clyde is saying, can we talk about the thing we need to talk about? And you're like, okay, obviously this is about their kid. And then it turns out it's about something entirely different. It's about how much time Bordas is spending away. And what I loved about it was this is back to a normal couple having a normal kind of interaction, except that the shadow of what happened is hanging all over all this. Because, like, it's never said, but I have to imagine, and we do actually learn later in later episodes, that part of why Bordas is not paying more attention to Clyden and is not spending more time with Clyden is because of that lingering tension. I thought that was such a great moment of saying, like, we're not going to spend an episode about the relationship again, but we're going to show you they are still trying to make a relationship work, but this hasn't gone away.
Yeah, totally. What impressed me most about that moment was I didn't know what episode I was watching when I started this episode. I didn't remember what, you know, If Only the Stars Appear meant. And when that happened, I was like, oh, this episode must be another Bordas and Clyden episode. Because it's obviously it's starting with this. It's got to be about them because that's how Star Trek works. If an episode starts with a character, it continues to be about that character. But that's really the only scene you see those two characters, at least much. They may have a few throwaway lines, but like they are just establishing that, hey, we didn't forget about that.
Yeah.
That's going to be an ongoing character thing that these two characters have a rift between them.
And it's just, I mean, like, I know I've been in situations like that where, like, there's some big fight that I'm having with a partner, and we've recognized that it can't be resolved, and there isn't some way to, there's no point in continuing to talk about it, but there's still that unresolved tension. All of a sudden, like, who did the dishes or who forgot the grocery shopping becomes much more emotionally charged conversations. Because on some level, we're talking about that other thing that we can't talk about anymore. And that was such a nuanced perspective of a difficult relationship that I was just incredibly impressed.
Yeah. And they don't even play it for a joke. Like, yeah. They, again, could have played the sort of trope of the spouse, the nagging spouse that made him go to work. It's like a serious moment in their relationship, and it's sort of a serious moment when he comes to the bridge, and you're like, I'm here early. And you're like, oh, man, he's really having a hard time at home. And then they drop it. They just don't even worry about it. It's like we're just laying this groundwork for later stuff to come and to show that we're not forgetting about their problems. That was really, really wonderful.
Yeah, and just such a nice reminder of, like, because sometimes I think one of my concerns sometimes about Star Trek is that, you know, it was obviously very episodic, but that generally, like, any problem that comes up can always be solved by the end of the episode. And I just love that this is like, nope, this is what these characters are going through, and they're not going to break up, they're not going to say, I hate you, but they have a strain in the relationship now. So, I will say my only complaint about that was, I remember really liking the idea of seeing what a relationship between two men would be like in a culture that's all men and how they would fall into different roles and things like that. In the way that fight is portrayed out, they wind up falling into, I felt, kind of gendered roles in that Bordas is the one who's being very sort of emotionally evasive and not wanting to talk about his feelings. And then Clyden winds up doing a number of things that are coded as being much more female in terms of, like, talking about his needs and then wanting comfort ice cream and a comfort movie. And I think there's a way to do that. That's like, those things don't have to be female. Like, they don't have to be gendered. Anyone can want that. there was a little bit about the way it was done that felt like it was sort of playing for a joke of like, look, haha, you know, Clyden's the girl in this relationship. I didn't love that. I just wanted to mention it. But I thought other than that, that scene was so good.
I did not take that as a joke in this in that way. I did take the particular things that like an alien eating ice cream is funny and and an alien watching that scene from The Sound of Music is very funny. Like that, those things were funny. I did not take it as haha, he's a lady.
Right.
But I do think that the show very clearly genders the two of them.
Yeah.
I don't know if I consider that problematic or not. Like I get that you might desire to see a different kind of thing, but in relationships, in many relationships, not all by any means, not at all trying to, you know, categorize everyone, but in many relationships, gay or straight, people tend to fall into those sort of roles.
Right.
And I think of even my relationship with my girlfriend, I actually think of us as a little gender flipped. We're heterosexual people, but she in many ways has a more masculine energy and I have a more feminine energy. And I often, not in all things, but in many things, we fall into those sort of opposite roles.
Right.
And I'm the more emotional one. She's the more logical one. Like, I think that often just happens with relationships. I don't think of that as necessarily a problematic thing for them to have a gendered relationship. Even though it would be an interesting exploration to see a different kind of show where, or a different kind of relationship where you don't have to have that.
I guess here's my take on it, because I'm the same way. Like, I do all the cooking and cleaning. My partner makes far more money than I do. She's really the breadwinner. I'm the much more, I want to process my feelings with her all the time. She doesn't. you know, but I guess the thing, and maybe I'm kind of going too much into gender theory here, and like, we don't have to go too deep on this, but. And you're right, maybe it's that I was hoping the show would do something that it just doesn't want to do, and that's fine. But my understanding of it is that part of the reason why we fall into those gendered roles, and especially that even we call them gendered roles, is that we are all products of societies that created gender roles and have enforced gender roles for thousands of years. And so we think we are – all the media we consume has sort of programmed us to think of relationships in those kind of terms. And to think about, like, you know, who's the woman in the relationship, and that we're, as like, I don't think either you or I would ever say that we're the woman in the relationship. I think because we're both claiming like you can be the man and be that. We're breaking that part of the gender thing, but that there is still a sort of gendered perspective to it. And I guess my point is that if you grew up in a society that was as overwhelmingly male as theirs was, and like early on, they do kind of establish that because they say, like, you know, kind of like what was their first date was to basically go on like an intense laser tag thing, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Which many women can love as well. It's not what I'm saying, but that it seemed like they were really trying to signal like these are two manly guys who are also in love. This just felt like a little, you know, it felt like they were playing for the joke, but also breaking a little the idea that they'd created of. This is an all-male world, so that those gendered ideas aren't going to exist as much.
And it's hard because I think they have set that up by making Clyden a stay-at-home dad.
Right.
And even a stay-at-home spouse before they had the kid. He is just kind of – and that's in our minds, in our culture currently, that sets him up as – so sort of having this feminine energy and like it does it the thing that I think makes it most problematic. I don't know. It's always hard because I'm always hesitant to make a show say like by saying this character has a more feminine energy, they're saying that has to be the way. Because it could just be the character choice they made for this character. Because later we do see like an ex of Clyden's, I mean of Bordis's.
Right.
And they're not that way. They're not feminine. And I don't know if it's, they're trying to say something about, they may not be trying to say anything, I guess is my point, but it's hard because obviously around these gender discussions, anytime you make any kind of show, you are taking a stance sort of by making a character make any kind of choice. And it's tough because then that makes it hard to make any kind of choice.
Yeah. No, I definitely understand that, and I guess it's just – I don't think they were trying to make a conscious statement about gender. I think they were trying to make a joke. And right. I felt like in doing that, they fell a little bit too much into a trope that I would have wanted them to. But other than that, I thought it was a fantastic scene.
Yeah.
What were the two things you wanted to bring up?
Oh, real quick, before I get to those, the one thing I was going to say, the thing that makes it most problematic, I started to say it and didn't, is that an episode ago, we found out that he was transgender. Which kind of puts it in this place of, like, he's still a girl.
Oh, you know, I hadn't even thought about that. But I don't know if I'd use the term transgender because it was so forcibly done.
Sure.
But yeah, but certainly, yeah, right, that he'd been born female and gone through this procedure. That'll be an interesting thing for us to keep looking at as we meet more characters who were born female and became male.
Yeah, and we've got Topa. I think through the eyes of Topa, we're going to explore some of that, and I don't know how artfully this show is going to do it. This show always has me walking on a razor's edge of, like, are they going to do this artfully or are they going to do it thoughtlessly?
Yeah.
Because it kind of, they go half and half sometimes.
And that's why there are probably some of our listeners who are like, why is Matthew so critical all the time of those kind of things? I think that what you just put it is exactly why. Like, I think there's so much I like about this show and so much that I think is positive that I do feel like it's important to sort of name those moments where it stumbles a little bit. But I think it's in part because it's sort of the first episode, I was expecting Family Guy. But Seth MacFarlane has raised my expectations so much by being so nuanced and sensitive to those things that when he's not, it's just a little glaring to me. And that's why I always want to point it out.
Yeah. So we've talked about so many different things, but I thought the main thrust of this episode was, how do you convince people?
Yeah, like, we haven't gotten to that.
That's the main thrust of what this episode's about. And it's actually – and I love this, that it was spoken – the wisdom was spoken not by the Federation and the Union characters. Mm-hmm. It was actually spoken by one of the reformers. They're talking about how stubborn people can be. And the kind of head reformer guy says, people refuse to change because it puts them in the wrong. It makes them realize they were wrong and they don't want to be wrong.
Yeah.
And I've actually been thinking about that a lot. We have that impulse as human beings to always push back against change just because it makes our previous version of ourself would have been wrong.
Think about the conversation we had at the beginning about how the leader is lying to himself and telling himself that all these horrible things he's doing are justified because they're for the good of the society. If he lets himself admit or lets others admit that actually this is not for the good of the society, his entire moral framework falls apart, you know?
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about, and I've talked a lot about my show Superhero Ethics, like the villain who thinks they're a hero. And one of the things I think happens is that villains will go further and further to fight those who make them think that they're not the hero. I think we see that in our own world all the time.
That's interesting.
And so, yeah, I think that's a great point you're making. Like, so much of this is about how do you convince people when admitting the thing you want them to admit basically invalidates everything they've done up to that point and makes them look like a horrible person.
And you know the one thing you don't do to make that happen?
What's that?
Yell at them and call them a horrible person.
Yeah.
That's like and that's the thing that on both sides of sort of the political spectrum right now, we're all doing all the time. On both extremes, everyone's yelling across the aisle and like calling each other out for being just horrible instead of trying to say, hey, let's think about this together. Let's like go through it and see who's right. And I think there's so much room for that in our culture. And that's what I feel like is so lacking in our political discussions, but that's not really in this show. I just wanted to say that.
I'm gonna push back on that but I'll tie it back to the show as well, because like I am definitely one of those people who yells and screams and calls people idiots sometimes, and I try not to make it personal invective, but sometimes it gets pretty heated. But the thing that I'm very conscious of, and I was thinking about in terms of the show, is I think you're 100% right. You will never convince someone they're wrong by calling them an idiot. But a lot of times in those discussions, and I think in this show, you're not just thinking about the person you're yelling at, you're thinking about the audience. Because like, there's also the question of, if I can make this person look like an idiot and point out to others that they're an idiot, will other people stop listening to them and stop following them and start thinking maybe my like nagging doubts about their wrongness are right?
Right.
And I do think to some extent, Kelly and the captain and them are trying to do that. I wish, and I think sometimes in Star Trek you would have this scene, and I kind of wish it had happened here, that the big confrontation with the leader had actually happened in front of the crowd. Hmm. Because I think you're right. They're never going to convince him. But I do, you know, because I think there would have been a really powerful moment of, like, you know, Kelly or Mercer or any of them, like, pointing out all the entire logical fallacies and horrible judgments that the leaders are making, and you getting to see the crowd be like, yeah, they're making a point. Like, because that's what I think you're right. Like, just two people sitting in a room yelling at each other over a Thanksgiving dinner table.
Sure.
That doesn't do anything. But if there's 10 other people at that Thanksgiving table who are listening, that's when I think it becomes important. You know?
Right.
And I think that that's the, and same thing on the internet. And I think that's the, that's where I think it was going here.
The problem with that is that so often the people that the followers also combine their identity with the person they're watching.
Uh-huh.
So instead of trying to have a conversation with them, if you're just yelling them down, then you're just as much attacking those people. So all those people out on the street that just killed a man, they're just as invested in that moral you know, framework as Hamilak is.
Right.
And so, like, Hamilak's in there doing bad things, and yeah, you could try to convince him, but, like, I'm not sure you're going to convince the people on the street by just going directly at him either.
Yeah.
Because they have just as much of a stake in being right as he does in that case. I don't know. And I think that's the case in our world too.
I think it's a mixed bag. And I think, and this is something I remember Star Trek exploring sometimes, and certainly other science fiction's done a good job. I think a lot of times we assume that everybody in a mob is equally as devoted to it, where the reality is that sometimes people, like, are starting to have their own individual doubts, but are so wrapped up in everything and see everyone else wrapped up in everything that they're never going to express their own doubts, you know? And that this 1984, I thought the book did a great job of expressing this, of, like, you know, that you're part of the mob, you're supposed to shout, you know, Hail Big Brother, or, you know, Kill the Heretic, or whatever it is. And so, but for those people who have a secret doubt, having someone else stand up and name that doubt and name maybe this is wrong, that can be a really powerful moment. And honestly, that I see online all the time. Like, a lot of times when I am, you know, sort of blasting someone a bit, and really, I don't want to make it sound like I'm a terrible troll. I really try to attack ideas, not to attack people.
Yeah.
But I'll often get private messages from people being like, you know what, I'm not ready to talk about this yet because I'm getting ostracized in my family or my community, but I kind of agree with you, and I'm really glad someone is saying it, you know? And I'm not tooting my own horn. I think a lot of people I know get those comments all the time. But I could have, like, that would have been a great scene, you know, to see, like, and the episode was too, would have been too long, you couldn't put this in, but how great would it have been to see, like, you know, focus on the face of one person in the crowd who seems to have a little bit of, like, hesitation before they start, like, in the process of doing the mob stuff.
Yeah.
And then later have that person, like, reacting when Mercer and Kelly are calling out the leader, you know?
Yeah, I think that would have been very interesting, and instead they chose to focus on Hamilak himself and his, which I was thankful for. I really like what they did with Hamilak and trying to make an examination of what is the leader like. And maybe we'll get that on another episode of something, of, you know, similar thing. I'm sure we'll have other despotic leaders to deal with. The last thing that I thought was really cool, what really cool slash really quick, was the decision to open the sky.
Yeah,
Mercer makes it very quickly, which I don't know how I feel about. I think it was more for the writing's sake. Like, you had to have that big moment at the end where they see the stars. So it's a beautiful moment. And it's about, like, revealing truth, and that's the way to convince these people, is, like, showing them actual truth.
Right.
But I just thought, I really liked the way that McFarlane acted that moment, because they tell him about it, and then there's a lot on his face there. He really looks like he considers it. He realizes, oh, this is going to irreparably change this culture. He's not happy about having to make that decision. He looks like there's a lot of weight on him, and he's like, open it. You know, like,
yeah.
he thinks it's the right thing to do. He knows it's the right thing to do because it's the truth. He thinks he's a believer in truth. And I, again, you know, we talked about last two or three episodes ago about we need to learn more about Mercer before you tell us the kind of man he is. And this was a moment where we learned, like, even though he seems to have, like, doubts about changing the society irreparably, he believes in truth. He thinks that the truth of the science of what is going on right here, the truth of this world needs to be told to this world so they can make an informed decision.
And I thought that was very funny because in some ways it's more he in this and this again this goes to the whole like the union has no prime directive whatsoever because if this had happened on a Star Trek show and you hadn't had the scene of Kirk and Spock and McCoy going round and round about the consequences of doing this and should they do it or not, or Picard calling the whole council together, or like at least just asking Troy, like, what will this do to the people? Mm-hmm. The fact that Mercer, you're right, he has an agonizing 10 seconds about it. But any other Star Trek person would be like, let's take a day to talk about this. Let's take a week. Let's talk to the Federation. And the fact that he's just like, yep, okay, I decided we're going to do it. Let's do it. I didn't think it was a bad thing, but it really surprised me because it's, you know, I do think that would be the kind of thing that would, we talked earlier about how a society like this is very brittle, you know, because it's based on these core assumptions with the idea that if you take those core assumptions away, the society will crumble. And often there's a perception of, so we need to gently work them into coming to terms with the actual reality of things. Mercer just takes a baseball bat to it.
Yeah.
And it did make me wonder, like, let's go back to that planet in a year and find all the people who are happy and doing well in this and are dealing with the, you know, have helped to figure out how to pilot the ship and they're deciding what to do with the ship. But let's also talk about the 5 to 10% of the population who are, like, you know, utterly psychologically broken by what has happened. Of, like, having their entire worldview shattered in just a few seconds.
Yeah, I do wish we had seen that. I wish that we had seen, because we see at the end the head reformer kind of taking lead and saying, well, I was right, and they're going to teach me how to pilot this ship. And they're sending a training crew, and the union's not leaving them, you know, without help.
Right.
But it was also, I really wish we had seen the other side, because obviously I'd like to see what Hamilak's response to the sky being opened is.
Yeah.
We do see it. We just see him look up and look, you know, kind of terrified / in awe.
Right.
But I don't think we don't get it. I wish we'd had a conversation afterwards. Maybe if Hamilak had been in that scene with the reformer and said, like, I was wrong. I see that now. I'm here, but I'm still a leader in this community and I want to help lead us into the future, you know? I would have liked to seen him have a reasoned conversation.
Well, and especially because in terms of Mercer's character, we talked before about how this is an interesting moment about him. But I feel like there was something missing here because, like, as I read his actions, I think that what he does makes a lot of sense in some ways, but is also incredibly dangerous. And therefore I think of it as like a very reckless move on his part. A very like, I think I know this is right, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And that would be a very interesting thing to say about his character, except I don't think the show realizes that it's a reckless move, you know, because I don't think they're not thinking about the fact that, I'm wondering if you saw it differently, but because to my mind it was like, I don't think the show was trying to say, I think the show believes, open it up, everything's going to be fine.
Based on the way McFarlane acted it, purely based on that, I think that at least McFarlane realized that it was a big decision.
Right.
But I think that the show decided, no matter if it's a big decision or not, this is how this episode has to end because it's kind of beautiful. It's showing the people truth, and it's this beautiful thing of the people seeing the stars for the first time. And the episode's called "If the Stars Should Appear." Like, I think that I think this is the key moment of the episode, and it's supposed to be one of the big moments we remember. And it is. Right. I remember that moment, but it is treated very quickly. Like I said, I think that McFarlane's acting here carries it, but barely. Like, it's quick. It's so quick.
Yeah, definitely.
You said 10 seconds, but I think it's like two. Because he says, the guy says, like, it turns out there's a way to open the things. And he just looks for a second. He turns internally for like a millisecond, like 2 seconds, and goes, open it. Like, it,
yeah.
And even the way he delivers the line well. I thought he did a lot of the work of that sort of moral ambiguity of his decision in the way he delivered it.
Yeah. I agree with that. I would have liked to see more about it, but I think you're right. It does. I don't think that we can take away from it that he's reckless, because I think that's not what the show thinks he's doing, even though it's what I think he's doing. But I certainly think it shows that he has that determination, and he's able to, like, in some ways, this is a turn for his character, because until now, we have seen him be very indecisive and very unsure.
Mm.
Even to the point of, like, you know, the Admiral not being sure if he could command because of that. And so it is a moment of him sort of, like, claiming his authority in a way.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting when you think about any of these shows, and, like, we think about who Captain Kirk is and who Picard is and now who Mercer is and who Sisko is, whoever. They're just a collection of what different writers chose to write that episode them doing, and it... In some ways, I think that in the early days of these shows, when you don't know how long they're going to go, you don't know where they're going, the writers don't know who Mercer is yet. And
yeah.
So they're weirdly, they are building who Mercer is every episode. And that's definitely true of like Kirk and Picard and all these older characters that, you know, they had no idea what Star Trek was going to be in 1969 or whatever, when
right.
they're like making episode to episode and just trying to make him be like a fun character to watch. And then we look back on that and we have all these, you know, theses on who Kirk is and what his decisions
oh, yeah.
mean.
I mean, I think it's a part of the fandom culture that's fun, but that also can kind of get away from itself. Like, I have read interviews or, like, listened to, you know, commentary tracks where actors or writers are talking about things. And at some point, like, someone will ask them, they'll be like, hey, you know, all the fans really think that this moment was such an interesting thing because you made this subtle point and therefore defined this part of the character. And the writer and the actor is like, I did what now? Like, you know, like, and I kind of wonder, like, if we interviewed Seth MacFarlane, you know, it may well be that he was saying, yeah, this is a really significant moment, and I really wanted to show the moral ambiguity of it. It maybe he was like, no, I just wanted the line to hit harder. You know,
like, right,
I have no idea. And I don't think it makes what we're talking about invalid, but I think it's a kind of fun thing of like, you know, it's a very postmodern idea of like the character can have meaning far beyond even what the writers and the actors intended.
Sure. Absolutely.
All right. So I think probably, do you have any kind of last thoughts on it or should we wrap up?
The only thing I didn't mention that's in my notes is that I haven't already deleted because I realized we didn't have time for it, I thought this episode with the humor found a particular rhythm that I liked.
Mm.
They did a lot of the humor in the moments on Star Trek that would have been boring. Like, it's a Star Trek episode, except when you're walking down the road with the characters in a way that would have normally been boring, or the elevator, or whatever. Like, they do these little things that are really funny, and they're mostly just in the patter between the characters. Like,
right.
This episode was taken very seriously in all of its beats, in all of its, you know, like we talked about a Girl last week. One of the major beats is a Rudolph joke. Where they put Rudolph thing, and I liked it in retrospect, but that's a big key moment in the show that is a joke, and this episode didn't do that. All of the key moments of the storyline are taken seriously, and the jokes are purely, you know, what happens in between those moments, and I liked that as a sort of model for what they, I think they kind of go forward doing. I think there's a lot less of those big things where the show turns on a joke.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think it's because I think that sometimes shows like that can forget, like, yeah, people are still people. You know, they're not just military automatons.
Yeah.
You know, again, returning to the theme, the only joke that I was uncomfortable with was once again, we have Yoffit being creepy to the doctor. I don't love that. But other than that, like, to me, my favorite joke moment, because it again felt so real, is when, what's the name of the, not Mercer, but the other lieutenant who's normally the navigator?
Lamar,
thank you. He, you know, has this theory about how to win the battle, and he's given the authority to do it, and he pulls it off really well. And he's so excited, and he breaks military protocol.
Yeah, and I love it so much. He jumps up.
It's
boom,
a funny moment,
bitch.
But it also looks very like, I think that's what people would do, especially like if you grew up in a video game culture kind of thing, like today. You know, like that's, I think I would do that in a moment like that. And I really appreciate Clyden's response, which is Clyden is to say, you know, hey, remember protocol, don't do that, but you did something really good, congratulations. And I thought that was such a nice way of, like, acknowledging, like, yes, you need to follow military protocol, but your celebration is also very warranted.
Yep, I totally agree. But I just thought it was funny. I agree with you completely. I like that he reprimands him, then praises him. But I also just thought that Lamar jumping up and down and saying "boom, bitch" was really, really wonderful.
It was really wonderful. Yeah, I loved it.
All right. Well, I think that's about all I have to say about this episode.
Me too.
We went about as long as we did last week, so maybe I'm wrong. Maybe we do have a lot more to say. I honestly think of these shows when I watch them as, oh, that's a nice little bite-sized piece of sci-fi. But then when we dig in, there's so many things, there's so many thoughtful things happening, and it makes me excited to continue doing this.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that Jacob and I have a joke that that we like to claim that it's because every episode has so much to say, and not for the fact that two of us are a little bit people who can talk at length about anything forever. And I think you and me are somewhat the same. Like,
I agree.
You could probably give us a phone book and we could find a way to have an hour-long conversation about it.
Yeah.
But definitely, we don't have to look hard with the Orville, because there is so much meat to these episodes. There's so much depth, even in the ones that seem like silly throwaway episodes.
Yeah, and I think adding to the fact that me and you don't always agree about a lot of the stuff necessarily, or how it's taken, and I enjoy that part of these discussions a lot, but I think it adds to the, like, I think I'm going to say something that'll just breeze by, and then you're like, but I have something to say about that, and then I'm like, yeah, but I have something to say about that. We kind of tend to go back and forth, which I love. I love the representation of different perspectives. I think it's a lot of fun.
No, definitely. I think as you said, this is going to kind of become a low-key political podcast, especially as the elections get nearer, and that'll be fun.
Oh yeah, that's going to be interesting.
Uh-huh.
All right. Well, thanks guys for listening. We'll be back next week with more Orville. Come watch it with us.
And just remember, in space, Liam Neeson is always secretly in charge.
Thanks for listening to the Orville Universe podcast. If you'd like to hear more from Matthew Westfox, search your podcatcher now for the Superhero Ethics podcast. If you'd like to hear more from me, Matthew Carroll, search your podcatcher for the Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast and the Star Trek Universe podcast. Or you can check out my music. Just search for Matthew Carroll wherever you listen to music.